This is Audible.
Listening Library presents I Was Here by Gail Forman. Read for you by Georgina Marie. For Susie Gonzalez. Chapter 1. The day after Meg died, I received this letter. I regret to inform you that I have had to take my own life. This decision has been a long time coming, and was mine alone to make. I know it will cause you pain, and for that I am sorry, but please know that I needed to end my own pain. This has nothing to do with you, and everything to do with me. It's not your fault. Meg. She emailed copies of the letter to her parents, and to me, and to the Tacoma Police Department, along with another note informing them which motel she was at, which room she was in, what poison she had ingested, and how her body should be safely handled. On the pillow at the motel room was another note, instructing the maid to call the police and not touch her body, along with a $50 tip. She sent the emails on a time delay, so that she would be long gone by the time we received them. Of course, I didn't know any of that until later, so when I first read Meg's email on the computer at our town's public library, I thought it had to be some kind of joke or a hoax. I called Meg, and when she didn't answer, I called her parents. "Did you get Meg's email?" I asked them. "What email?" Chapter 2. There are memorial services, and there are vigils, and then there are prayer circles. It gets hard to keep them straight. At the vigils, you hold candles, but sometimes you do that at the prayer circles. At the memorial services, people talk, though what is there to say? It was bad enough she had to die on purpose. But for subjecting me to all of this, I could kill her. "Cody, are you ready?" Trisha calls. It is late on a Thursday afternoon, and we are going to the fifth service in the past month. This one is a candlelight vigil, I think. I emerge from my bedroom. My mother is zipping up the black cocktail dress she picked up from the Goodwill after Meg died. She's been using it as her funeral dress, but I'm sure that once this blows over, it'll go into rotation as a going-out dress. She looks hot in it. Like so many people in town, mourning becomes her. "Why aren't you dressed?" she asks. "All my nice clothes are dirty." "What nice clothes?" "Fine, all my vaguely funereal clothes are dirty."
"Dirty never stopped you before."
We glare at each other. When I was 8, Trisha announced I was old enough to do my own laundry. I hate doing laundry. You can see where this leads. "I don't get why we have to go to another one," I say.
"Because the town needs to process."
"Cheese needs to process. The town needs to find another drama to distract itself with." There are 1,574 people in our town, according to the fading sign on the highway. 1,573, Meg said when she escaped to college in Tacoma on a full scholarship last fall. 1,572 when you come to Seattle and we get our apartment together, she'd added. It remains stuck at 1,573 now, and I suspect it'll stay there until someone else is born or dies. Most people don't leave. Even when Tammy Henthoff and Matt Parner left their respective spouses to run off together, the gossip that was the hottest news before Meg, they moved to an RV park on the edge of town. Do I have to go? I'm not sure why I bothered to ask her this. Trisha is my mother, but she's not an authority in that way.
I know I have to go. And I know why. For Joe and Sue. They're Meg's parents. Or they were. I keep stumbling over the verb tenses. Do you cease being someone's parents because they died? Because they died on purpose? Joe and Sue look blasted into heartbreak, the hollows under their eyes so deep. I don't see how they'll ever go away. And it's for them I find my least stinky dress and put it on. I get ready to sing. Again. Amazing grace. How vile the sound. Chapter 3. I've written a dozen mental eulogies for Meg, imagining all the things I might say about her. Like how when we met in the first week of kindergarten, she made me a picture of us, with both of our names, and some words I didn't understand because unlike Meg, I could not yet read or write.
"It says best friends," she explained.
And like all things Meg wanted or predicted, it turned out to be true. I might talk about how I still have that picture. I keep it in a metal toolbox that houses all my most important things, and it is creased from age and multiple viewings. Or I might talk about how Meg knew things about people that they might not know themselves. She knew the precise number of times in a row everyone generally sneezed. There's a pattern to it, apparently. I was 3, Scotty and Sue 4, Joe was 2, Meg was 5. Meg could also remember what you wore for every picture day, every Halloween. She was like the archive of my history. And also the creator of it, too. Because almost every one of those Halloweens was spent with her, usually in some costume she dreamed up. Or I might talk about Meg and her obsession with Firefly songs. It started in 9th grade, when she picked up a vinyl single by a band called Heavens to Betsy. She dragged me back to her room and played me the scratchy record on that old turntable she'd bought at a church jumble sale for $1, and rewired herself, with a little help from YouTube instructional videos. And you will never know how it feels to light up the sky. You will never know how it feels to be a firefly. Corin Tucker sang in a voice so simultaneously strong and vulnerable that it seemed almost inhuman. After the Heavens to Betsy discovery, Meg went on a mission to find every good Firefly song ever written. In true Meg fashion, within a few weeks she'd amassed an exhaustive list. "Have you ever even seen a Firefly?" I'd asked her as she worked on her playlist. I knew she hadn't. Like me, Meg had never been east of the Rockies. "I have time," she'd said, opening her arms, as if to demonstrate just how much life there was out there, waiting for her. Joe and Sue asked me to speak at that first service, the big one that should have been held in the Catholic church the Garcias had attended for years, but wasn't, because Father Grady, though a friend of the family, was a rules man. He told the Garcias that Meg had committed a cardinal sin, and therefore her soul wouldn't be admitted to heaven, nor her body to the Catholic cemetery. The last bit was theoretical. It took a while for the police to release her body. Apparently, the poison she'd used was rare, though anyone who knew Meg wouldn't be surprised by this. She never wore clothes from chain stores, always listened to bands no one else had heard of. Naturally, she found some obscure poison to swallow. So the casket everyone sobbed over at that first big service was empty, and there was no burial. I overheard Meg's uncle Xavier tell his girlfriend that maybe it would be better if there never was one. No one knew what to write on the gravestone. "Everything sounds like a reproach," he said. I tried to write a eulogy for that service. I did. I pulled out the disc Meg had burned of Firefly songs for inspiration. The 3rd one up was the Bishop Allen track, Fireflies. I don't know if I had ever really listened to the words before, because when I did now, they were like a smack from her grave.
It says you can still forgive her, and she will forgive you back. But I don't know that I can. And I don't know that she did. I told Joe and Sue that I was sorry, that I couldn't give a eulogy because I couldn't think of anything to say. It was the first time I ever lied to them. Today's service is being held in the Rotary Club, so it's not one of the official religious services, though the speaker appears to be some kind of reverend. I'm not sure where they keep coming from, all these speakers who didn't really know Meg. After it's over, Sue invites me over for yet another reception at the house. I used to spend so much time at Meg's house that I could tell what kind of mood Sue was in by what I smelled when I walked through the door. Butter meant baking, which meant she was melancholy and needed cheering. Spicy meant she was happy and making hot Mexican food for Joe, even though it hurt her stomach. Popcorn meant that she was in bed, in the dark, not cooking anything, and Meg and Scotty were left to their own devices, which meant a buffet of microwave snack foods. On those days, Joe would joke how lucky we kids were to get to pig out like this as he made his way upstairs to check on Sue. We all played along, but usually, after the second or third microwave corn dog, you kind of wanted to throw up. I know the Garcias so well that when I called that morning after getting Meg's email, I knew even though it was 11 o'clock on a Saturday that Sue would be still in bed, but not sleeping. She said she never did learn to sleep in once her kids stopped waking up early. And Joe would have the coffee brewed and the morning paper spread out over the kitchen table. Scotty would be watching cartoons. Consistency was one of the many things I loved about Meg's house. So different from mine, where the earliest Trisha usually woke was noon, and some days you might find her pouring bowls of cereal, and some days you might not find her at all. But now there's a different kind of constancy about the Garcia household, one that is far less inviting. Still, when Sue asks me over, much as I'd prefer to refuse the invitation, I don't. The crowd of cars outside the house is thinner than it was in the early days, when the whole town came on sympathy calls carrying Pyrex dishes. It was a little hard to take, all those casseroles and the, "I'm so sorry for your losses," that accompanied them. Because elsewhere in town, the gossip was flying. Didn't surprise me. Girl always hung her freak flag high, I heard people whispering in the Circle K. Meg and I both knew that some people said things like that about her. In our town, she was like a rose blooming in the desert. It confused folks. But with her dead, this sentiment no longer felt like a badge of honor. And it wasn't just Meg they went after. At Trisha's bar, I overheard a couple of townies sniping about Sue. As a mother, I would know if my daughter was suicidal. This coming from the mother of Carrie Tarkington, who had slept with half the school. I was about to ask Mrs. Tarkington if, being all-knowing, she knew that. But then her friend replied, "Sue, are you joking? That woman is floating in space on a good day." And I felt sucker-punched by their cruelty. "How would you feel if you'd just lost your child, you bitches?" I sneered. Trisha had to escort me home. After today's service, Trisha has to work, so she drops me off at the Garcias. I let myself in. Joe and Sue hug me tight, and for a moment longer than is comfortable. I know that they must take some solace in me being here, but I can hear Sue's silent questions when she looks at me, and I know that all the questions boil down to one. Did you know? I don't know what could be worse, if I did know and didn't tell them, or the truth, which is that even though Meg was my best friend, and I have told her everything there is to tell about me, and I'd assumed she'd done the same, I'd had no idea. Not a clue. "This decision has been a long time coming," she wrote in her note. A long time coming? How long is that? Weeks? Months? Years? I've known Meg since kindergarten. We have been best friends, sisters almost, ever since. How long has this decision been coming without her telling me? And more to the point, why didn't she tell me? After about 10 minutes of sitting in sad, polite silence, Scotty, Meg's 10-year-old brother, comes up to me with their, or now his, dog Samson on a leash. "Lockies," he says, to me as much as to Samson. I nod and stand up. Scotty seems to be the only one who retains any semblance of his former self, which is maybe because he's young, though he's not that young, and he and Meg were close. When Sue would disappear into one of her moods and Joe would disappear to take care of her, Meg was the one to mother Scotty. It's late April, but no one has alerted the weather. The wind kicks up fierce and cold with a mean grit. We walk toward the big empty field that everyone lets their dogs shit in, and Scotty unleashes Samson. He bounds off, jubilant, happy in his canine ignorance. "How are you holding up, Brentmeyer?" I feel false using the old jocular nickname, and I already know how he's doing. But with Meg no longer playing Mother Hen, and Sue and Joe lost in their grief, someone has to at least ask. "I'm up to level 6 on Fiend Finder," he says. He shrugs. "I get to play all I want now." A side benefit. And then I clamp my hand over my mouth. My bitter gallows humor is not meant for public consumption. But Scotty lets out a gruff laugh. Way too old for his age. "Yeah, right." He stops and watches Samson sniff a collie's butt. On the way home, Samson straining at his leash because he knows food is next, Scotty asks me, "You know what I don't get?" I think we're still talking about video games, so I'm not prepared for what he says next. "I don't get why she didn't send me the note, too." "Do you even have an email address?" I ask, like this was her reason. He rolls his eyes. "I'm 10, not 2. I've had one since 3rd grade. Meg emailed me stuff all the time." "Oh, well, she probably wanted to spare you." For a second, his eyes look just as hollowed out as his parents'. "Yeah, she spared me." Back at the house, the guests are leaving. I catch Sue dumping a tuna casserole into the garbage. She gives me a guilty look. When I go to hug her goodbye, she stops me. "Can you stay?" she asks in that voice of hers, so quiet, so different from Meg's garrulous one. Meg's voice that could make anyone do anything, anytime. "Of course." She gestures toward the living room where Joe is sitting on the couch, staring into space, ignoring Samson, who is begging at his feet for the expected dinner. In the fading twilight, I look at Joe. Meg took after him with his dark Mexican looks. He seems like he's aged 1,000 years in the past month.
"Cody,"
he says. One word, and it's enough to make me cry. "Hi, Joe."
"Sue wants to talk to you. We both do."
My heart starts to hammer. Because I wonder if they're finally going to ask me if I knew anything. I had to answer some cursory questions from the police when all this went down, but they had more to do with how Meg might have procured the poison. And I had no idea about any of that, except that if Meg wanted something, she usually found a way to get it. After Meg died, I went and looked up all the suicide signs online. Meg didn't give me any of her prized possessions. She didn't talk about killing herself. I mean, she used to say things like, "If Ms. Dobson gives us another pop quiz, I am going to shoot myself." But does that count? Sue sits down next to Joe on the worn couch. They look at each other for half a second. But then it's like that hurts too much. They turn to me, like I'm Switzerland. Cascade's term ends next month, they tell me. I nod. University of the Cascades is the prestigious private college where Meg got a scholarship. The plan had been for both of us to move to Seattle after high school graduation. We'd been talking about this since eighth grade. Both of us at the University of Washington, sharing a dorm room for the first 2 years, then living off campus for the duration. But then Meg had gotten this amazing full ride at Cascades, a way better package than what the UW offered. As for me, I'd gotten into the UW, but without scholarships of any kind. Trisha had made it pretty clear she couldn't help me. I finally got myself out of debt. So, in the end, I turned down the UW and decided to stay in town. My plan was to do 2 years at community college, then transfer to Seattle to be near Meg. Joe and Sue sit there quietly. I watch Sue pick at her nails. The cuticles are a complete mess. Finally, she looks up. The school has been very kind. They've offered to pack up her room and ship everything to us. But I can't bear a stranger's hands touching her things. And what about her roommates? Cascades is tiny and hardly has any dorms. Meg lived off campus in a house shared with some other students. Apparently, they've just locked up her room and left it like that. Her rent's paid through the end of the term, but now we should empty it out and bring everything. Her voice catches.
Home.
Joe finishes for her. It takes me a second to realize what they want, what they're asking me. And at first I'm relieved because it means I don't have to fess up that I didn't know what Meg was contemplating. That the one time in her life she might have needed me, I failed her. But then, the weight of what they're asking skids and crashes in my stomach. Which isn't to say I won't do it. I will. Of course I will. You want me to pack up her things, I say. They nod. I nod back. It's the least I can do. After your classes end, of course, Sue says. Officially, my classes end next month. Unofficially, they did the day I got Meg's email. I've got Fs now. Or incompletes. The distinction hardly seems to matter.
And if you can get the time off work.
This from Joe. He says it respectfully, as if I have an important job. I clean houses. The people I work for, like everyone in this town, know about Meg. And they've all been very nice, telling me to take all the time I need. But empty hours to contemplate Meg aren't what I need. I can go whenever, I say. Tomorrow, if you want.
She didn't have very much. You can take the car, Joe says.
Joe and Sue have one car, and it's like a NASA expedition how they plot out their days so Sue can drop Joe off at work and get Scotty to school and get herself to work and then scoop them all back up again at the end of the day. On weekends, it's more of the same, doing the grocery shopping and all the errands there's no time for during the week. I don't have a car. Occasionally, very occasionally, Trisha lets me use hers. Why don't I take the bus? She doesn't have that much. Didn't. Joe and Sue look relieved.
We'll pay for your bus tickets. You can ship any extra boxes UPS, Joe says.
And you don't have to bring everything back, Sue pauses. Just the important things. I nod. They look so grateful that I have to look away. The trip is nothing, a 3-day errand, a day to get there, a day to pack, a day to get home. It's the kind of thing Meg would have offered to do, without having to be asked first. Chapter 4. Every so often I'll read some hopeful article about how Tacoma is gentrifying so much that it's rivaling Seattle. But when my bus pulls into the deserted downtown, it all feels kind of desperate, like it's trying too hard and failing.
sort of like some of Trisha's friends from the bar, 50-year-old women who wear miniskirts and platforms and makeup but aren't fooling anyone. Mutton disguised as lamb is how the guys in our town describe them. When Meg left, I promised I'd come visit once a month, but I wound up coming only one time. Last October. I'd bought a ticket to Tacoma, but when the bus pulled into Seattle, Meg was waiting at the station. She'd had this idea we'd spend the day roaming Capitol Hill, have dinner at some hole-in-the-wall dumpling place in Chinatown, and go out to see a band play in Belltown. All the things we'd talked about doing when we moved here together. She was so hyped about the plan. I couldn't quite tell if the day was her idea of a sales pitch or a consolation prize. Either way, it was a bust. The weather was rainy and cold, whereas back home it had been clear and cold. Another reason not to move to Seattle, I told myself. And none of the places we visited, the vintage clothing shops and comic book stores and coffee houses, seemed as cool as I'd thought they would be. At least that's what I told Meg. Sorry, she said. Not sarcastically, but sincerely, as though Seattle's shortcomings were her fault. It was a lie, though. Seattle was great. Even with the rotten weather, I'd have loved living here. But I'm sure I'd have loved living in New York or Tahiti or a million other places I'd never get to. We were meant to go see a band play that night. Some people Meg knew, but I begged off, claiming I was tired. We went back to her house in Tacoma. I was supposed to stay most of the next day, but I told her I had a sore throat and caught an early bus home. Meg invited me to come again, but I always had reasons why I couldn't. My schedule was busy, bus fare wasn't cheap, both of which were true, even if they weren't the truth. It takes two buses to get from downtown to Cascade's tiny, leafy waterfront campus. Joe had instructed me to go to the administration building to get some papers and a key. Even though Meg had lived off campus, the university runs all student housing. When I explain who I am, they immediately know why I'm here, because I get that look. I hate that look, and I've come to know it well. Practiced empathy. "We're so sorry for your loss," the lady says. She is fat and wearing the drapey kind of clothes that only make her bigger. "We've been holding weekly support groups for those impacted by Megan's death. If you'd care to join us for one, there's another gathering coming up." Megan? Nobody but her grandparents called her that. She hands me some literature, a color copy with a big smiling picture of Meg that I don't recognize. On top it says, "Lifeline, with hearts dotting the I's." "It's Monday afternoon. 'Fraid I'll be gone by then." "Oh, shame." She pauses. "They've been very cathartic for the campus community. People are quite shocked." Shocked is not the word for it. Shocked is when I finally got Trisha to tell me who my father was, only to find out that up until I was 9, he'd been living not 20 miles away from us. What happened with Meg is something altogether different. It's like waking up one morning and finding out you live on Mars now. "I'm only here for a night," I tell her. "Oh, shame," she says again. "Yes, shame." She hands me a set of keys and gives me directions to the house and tells me to call if I need anything. And I'm out the door before she hands me a card, or worse, gives me a hug. At Meg's old house, no one answers when I knock, so I let myself in. Inside, it smells of beer and pizza and bong water, and something else. The ammonia scent of a dirty cat box. There's the sound of jam bands, fish or widespread panic. The kind of bad hippie music, I muse, that would make Meg want to shoot herself. Then I catch myself and remember that she did, in effect, shoot herself. "Who are you?" A tall and ridiculously pretty girl stands before me. She's wearing a tie-dyed peace sign t-shirt, and she is sneering.
I'm Cody. Reynolds.
I'm here for Meg, for her stuff. She stiffens, as if Meg, the mention of her, the existence of her, has completely harshed her mellow. I already hate this girl. And when she introduces herself as Tree, I wish Meg were around so we could give each other that imperceptible look we've developed over the years to register our mutual disdain. Tree?
Are you one of her roommates? I ask.
When she first arrived, Meg sent me long emails about her classes, her professors, her work-study job, and in some cases, these hilarious character portraits of each roommate, actual charcoal drawings she scanned for me. It was the kind of thing that normally I'd have adored, reveling in her haughtiness, because that's how it had always been. Meg and me versus the world. Back home, they referred to us as the pod. But reading the emails, I had the sense that she was purposefully playing up her roommate's faults to make me feel better, which only made me feel worse. In any case, I didn't recall a Tree.
I'm friends with Rich.
Bitchy hippie Tree replies to me.
Ah, Stoner Richard, as Meg called him. I met him last time I was here.
I'll get on with it, I say.
You do that,
Tree replies. Such open hostility is a shock after a month of people tippy-toeing around me. Outside Meg's door, I half expect one of those shrines that have popped up in town. Whenever I see one, I want to yank the heads off the flowers or throw the candles. But that's not what I find. There's an album cover pasted on the door. Poison Ideas, Feel the Darkness. The image is of a guy holding a revolver to his head. This is her roommate's idea of a memorial? Breathing hard, I unlock the door and turn the knob. Inside, it's not what I expect either. Meg was notoriously messy, her bedroom at home full of teetering stacks of books and CDs, drawings, half-completed DIY projects, a lamp she was trying to rewire, a Super 8 film she was trying to edit. Sue said that her roommates had just locked the door and left it as was, but it looks like someone has been in here. The bed is made, and much of her stuff is already neatly folded. There are unassembled boxes under the bed. It will take 2 hours to do this at most. Had I known, I would have taken the Garcia's car and done it as a day trip. Sue and Joe had offered me money for a motel, but I didn't accept it. I know how little they have, how every spare cent went toward Meg's education, which, even with a full scholarship, still had all kinds of hidden costs. And her death has been a whole other expense. I said I would sleep here, but now that I'm in her room, I can't help thinking of the last time, the only time, I slept here. Meg and I have shared beds, cots, sleeping bags, without a problem since we were little. But the night of my visit, I'd lain in bed awake next to a soundly sleeping Meg. She was snoring slightly and I kept kicking her, like it was her snoring that was keeping me awake. When we got up Sunday morning, something mean and hard had taken root in my belly, and I felt myself itching for a fight. But the last thing I'd wanted to do was fight with Meg. She hadn't done anything. She was my best friend. So I'd left early, and not because of any sore throat. I go back downstairs. The music has changed from Fish to something a little more rocking. The Black Keys, I think, which is better, if a strange turn. There's a group of people sitting on a purple velour couch, divvying up a pizza and a 12-pack. Tree is with them, so I walk on by, ignoring them, ignoring the smell of pizza that makes my stomach gurgle because I haven't eaten anything, except for a Little Debbie snack cake on the bus. Outside, it's misting. I walk a ways until I get to a stretch of diners. I sit down at one and order a coffee, and when the waitress gives me a dirty look, I get an anytime $2.99 breakfast and figure that this earns me the right to camp here for the night. After a few hours and 4 or 5 refills, she mostly leaves me be. I take out my book, wishing I'd brought some page-turnery thriller. But Mrs. Banks, the town librarian, has me on a Central European author kick these days. She goes through phases like that with me, has done ever since I was 12, and she spotted me reading a Jackie Collins novel at Trisha's bar, where I sometimes had to hang out when Trisha worked. Mrs. Banks asked what else I liked to read, and I rattled off a few titles, mostly paperbacks Trisha had brought home from the break room. "You're quite a reader," Mrs. Banks said, and then she invited me to come to the library the following week. When I did, she got me signed up for a card and loaned me copies of Jane Eyre and Pride and Prejudice. "When you finish, tell me if you like them, and I'll get you something else." I read them in 3 days. I'd liked Jane Eyre best, even though I hated Mr. Rochester and wished he'd died in the fire. Mrs. Banks had smiled at that, then handed me Persuasion and Wuthering Heights. I tore through those in a few days. From that point on, I would go into the library at least once a week to see what books she had for me. It seemed amazing that our tiny branch had such an endless stock of books, and it was years later that I'd learned that Mrs. Banks was special ordering books through interlibrary loan that she thought I'd like. But tonight, the contemplative Milan Kundera she gave me is making my eyelids heavy. Every time they flutter closed, that waitress, as if possessing radar, comes by to refill my coffee, even though I haven't touched it since the last refill. I hold out until about 5 in the morning, and then pay my bill and leave a big tip, because I'm not sure if the waitress was being rude by not letting me sleep, or if she was keeping me from getting kicked out. I wander around the campus until the library opens at 7, and then I find a quiet corner and fall asleep for a few hours. When I make my way back to Meg's house, a guy and a girl are drinking coffee on the porch.
"Hey," the guy says. "Cody, right?"
"Yeah."
"Richard," he says.
"Right. We met before," I say.
He doesn't seem to remember. He was probably too stoned.
"I'm Alice," the girl says. I remember Meg mentioning a new roommate moving in for the winter term, taking the place of some other girl who transferred out after one semester.
"Where'd you go?" he asks.
"I stayed in a motel," I lie.
"Not the Starline?"
Alice asks in alarm.
"What?"
It takes me a second to realize that the Starline is the motel. Meg's motel.
"No, some other dive."
"Would you like some coffee?" Alice asks. All the coffee I drank last night has turned acidic in my stomach, and though I'm hazy and exhausted, I can't fathom drinking any more. I shake my head.
"Want to smoke a bowl?"
Stoner Richard asks.
"Richard!"
Alice swats at him. "She has to pack up all that stuff. I don't think she wants to be stoned."
"I'd think she'd want to be stoned," Stoner Richard replies.
"I'm good," I say. But the sun is fighting its way out of the thin haze of cloud, and it's making everything so bright that I feel dizzy.
"Sit down. Eat something," Alice says. "I'm practicing making bread, and I have a new loaf."
"It's slightly less brick-like than usual," Richard promises.
"It's good," Alice pauses, "if you slather it with lots of butter and honey."
I don't want the bread. I didn't want to get to know these people before, and I certainly don't want to now. But Alice is gone and back with the bread before I know it. The bread is kind of dense and chewy, but she's right. With butter and honey, it's decent. I finish it up and brush the crumbs from my lap. Well, I'd better get to it. I start toward the door. Though someone already did the heavy lifting. Do you know who packed up her stuff like that? Stoner Richard and Alice look at each other.
That's how she left the room, Alice says. She packed it up herself.
Girl was on top of shit till the bitter end, Richard adds. He looks at me and grimaces. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. It saves me work, I say. And my voice sounds so nonchalant, like this is such a load off my plate. It takes about 3 hours to pack the rest of her stuff. I pull out holy t-shirts and underwear, because why do they need that? I throw away her stacks of music magazines, piled in a corner. I'm not sure what to do about her bedsheets, because they still smell like her. And I have no idea if her scent will do to Sue what it's doing to me, which is making me remember Meg in such a real, visceral way. Sleepovers and dance parties, and those talks we would have until 3 in the morning that would make us feel lousy the next day, because we'd slept like hell, but also feel good, because the talks were like blood transfusions, moments of realness and hope that were pinpricks of light in the dark fabric of small-town life. I am tempted to inhale those sheets. If I do, maybe it will be enough to erase everything. But you can only hold your breath for so long. Eventually I'll have to exhale her, and then it'll be like those mornings, when I wake up, forgetting, before remembering. The UPS place is downtown, and I'll have to get a taxi, cart the stuff over, ship it, come back for the duffels, and be ready to catch the last bus at 7. Downstairs, Alice and Stoner Richard are where I left them. It's unclear to me if these students at this supposedly well-regarded college ever actually study. I'm pretty much done, I tell them. Just have to close the boxes and I'll be out of here.
We'll get the cats for you before you go, Stoner Richard offers.
The cats? Meg's 2 kittens, Alice says. She looks at me and cocks her head to the side. She didn't tell you about them? I refuse to show any surprise or hurt. I don't know anything about any cats, I say. She found these 2 stray kittens a couple months ago. They were totally emaciated and sick.
Nasty shit coming out of their eyes, Stoner Richard adds.
Yes, they had some kind of eye infection, among other maladies. Meg took them in. She spent a ton of money at the animal hospital on treatments, and then she nursed them back to health. She loved those kittens. She shakes her head. That's what was the biggest surprise to me, that she'd go through all that trouble for the kittens and then... You know...
Yeah.
Well, Meg worked in mysterious ways, I say.
The bitterness is so strong, I swear they must be able to smell it on my breath.
And the cats are of no concern to me. But someone has to take them, Alice says. The house has been looking out for them, but we're not supposed to have pets, and we're all leaving for the summer, and none of us can take them.
I shrug. I'm sure you'll think of something.
Have you seen these kittens?
Alice goes to the side of the house and starts making kissing sounds. And soon enough, 2 tiny furballs bound into the living room.
This one's Pete, she says, pointing to the mostly gray one with a black splodge on its nose. And the other one's Repeat.
Pete and Repeat went out in a boat. Pete fell out. Who was saved? Meg's Uncle Xavier told us this joke, and we used to torment each other with it.
Repeat, Repeat, Repeat. Alice puts a kitten in my arms, where it immediately starts doing that pawing thing that cats do when they're trying to find milk. But then it gives up and falls asleep, a little ball against my chest. Something tickles inside, an echo from another time when it wasn't all frozen in there. The cat starts to purr, and I'm screwed.
Is there, like, an animal shelter here?
There is, but there are dozens of cats there, and they only keep them for 3 days before... You know.
Alice mimes a knife to the throat.
Pete, or maybe it's Repeat, is still purring in my arms. I can't bring them home. Trisha would have a shit fit. She'd refuse to let them come inside, and then they'd get eaten by coyotes or killed by the cold in no time.
I could ask if Sue and Joe wanted them. But I've seen the way Samson goes after cats.
Seattle has a few no-kill shelters, Stoner Richard says. I saw an Animal Liberation Front thing about it.
I sigh. Fine. I'll swing up to Seattle on my way out of town and drop the cats off.
Stoner Richard laughs. It's not like dry cleaning. You can't just drop them off. You have to make an appointment for, like, an intake or something.
When have you ever had anything dry cleaned? Alice asks him. Pete / Repeat mules in my arms. Alice looks at me. How long is your drive back? 7 hours, plus I have to ship the boxes. She looks at me and then at Stoner Richard. It's 3 now. Maybe you should go up to Seattle and bring the cats to a shelter, and you can leave first thing tomorrow. Can't you bring the cats to a shelter? I ask her. You seem to have it all worked out. I have a women's studies paper I need to work on. What about after you finish? She falters for a second. No. Those cats were Meg's thing. I don't feel right sending them to a shelter. Oh, so you'll leave the dirty work to me? I hear the anger in my voice, and I know that it's not Alice who's left me the dirty work. But when she cringes, I get a grim twist of satisfaction.
Dude, I'll drive you to Seattle, Stoner Richard says. We'll get the feline settled, and you can come here and get out of town first thing in the morning.
He seems like he wants to be rid of me as much as I want to be rid of him. At least it's mutual. Chapter 5 Seattle pet shelters, it turns out, are harder to get into than the hippest velvet rope nightclubs. The first two are full, and no amount of begging works. The third one has space, but it requires an application and a copy of the cat's vet records. I tell the pierced girl with her hipster no-leather shoes that I'm leaving town, that I have the cats in the car, and she gives me the most snide look in the world and tells me that I should have thought of this before I went and adopted a pet. I almost smack her.
Want to smoke that bowl now?
Stoner Richard asks after strike 3. It's 8 o'clock, and the shelters are all closed for the night. No.
You want to go to a club or something? Blow off steam? Since we're in Seattle?
I'm exhausted from the night before, and I don't want to be here with Stoner Richard, and I'm trying to figure out how I'll get vet records when tomorrow is Sunday. I start to beg off, but then Richard says,
We can go to one of those hole-in-the-walls that Meg liked to go to. Once in a while she'd deign to let us tag along.
He pauses.
She had a whole clutch of friends up here.
I'm momentarily stunned by Richard's use of both deign and clutch. But the truth is, I do actually want to see these places. I think of the club we were meant to have gone to the weekend I came to visit. All the clubs we were meant to have gone to, all the weekends I didn't come to visit. I know how excited Meg was to be amid the music scene, though after the time I visited her, the breathless emails about it all started to taper off, and then stopped. What about the kittens? I ask Richard.
They'll be fine in the car, Richard says. It's like 55 degrees tonight. They have food and water.
He points to Pete and Repeat, who, having squealed and yowled the entire drive up, are now quietly nestled together in their carrier. We drive to a club in Fremont by the canal. Before we go in, Richard lights up a small pipe and smokes out the window.
Don't want to give the kiddies a contact high, he jokes.
As we pay our covers, he tells me that Meg went here a lot. I nod as if I know this. The place is empty. It smells of stale beer, bleach, and desperation. I leave Richard at the bar and go play pinball by myself. By 10 o'clock, the room starts filling up, and by 11, the first of the night's bands comes on. A very feedback-heavy outfit whose lead singer growls more than he sings. After a few okay songs, Stoner Richard finds me.
That's Ben McAllister,
he says, pointing to the guitar player / growler. Uh-huh, I say. I've never heard of him. It takes a while for the Seattle scene to filter all the way down to Shitburg.
Did Meg mention him to you?
No, is all I say. Though I want to scream at people to stop asking me that, because I don't know what Meg told me, and I ignored, and what Meg didn't tell me. Although one thing I know for damn certain is that she didn't tell me that she was in such intense pain that the only way to take it away was to order a batch of industrial poison and drink it down. Stoner Richard is going on about Meg being obsessed with the guy, and it's all sort of white noise, because Meg was obsessed with a lot of guitar players in her day, and in her way. But then, this particular guitar player, this Ben McAllister, he stops to take a pull from his beer, holding the long neck of the bottle between two fingers, his guitar hanging off his lanky hip like it's a limb. And then he turns out toward the crowd and the lights are on him bright, and I see that his eyes are impossibly blue. And he does this thing, like he's shielding his eyes from the sun and looking out into the crowd for someone. But the way he does it, it makes something click. Oh, that must be Tragic Guitar Hero, I say.
Nothing heroic about that guy, Stoner Richard says.
Tragic Guitar Hero. I do remember her writing about him once or twice, which was notable, because she hadn't written about any guys. At first it seemed she was into his band, and she crushed on him the way that she always crushed on the guys and the girls she met in bands. Tragic Guitar Hero. She told me about his band. Retro sonic youth velvet underground sound, infused with some modern sensibilities. Typical Meg stuff. But she'd also written about his eyes, so blue she'd thought he wore contacts. I look at them now. They are weirdly blue. And then I remember a line from one of her emails. Meg had asked, "Do you remember the advice that Trisha gave us back when she started working at the bar?" Trisha loved to dispense advice, especially when she had an audience as attentive as Meg. But somehow I'd known right away which pointer Meg was talking about. "Never sleep with the bartender, girls," Trisha had warned us. "Why? Because everyone does?" Meg had asked. She loved the way Trisha talked to us, as if we were her friends from the bar, as if either of us was sleeping with anyone. "There's that," Trisha had replied, "but mostly because you stopped getting free drinks." Meg had written that it held true for Tragic Guitar Heroes, too. And I'd been confused because Meg hadn't mentioned being into this guy or going out with him, let alone sleeping with him, something she had never done. Except for that one time that we had both decided didn't really count. And surely if Meg had done something as momentous as sleeping with the guy, she'd have told me. I was going to ask her about it when she came home. And then she didn't. So that's him. That's Tragic Guitar Hero. He seemed so mythic, and usually attaching a name to a mythical creature tames it. But knowing his name, Ben McAllister, doesn't do that. I watch the band intently now. He does that thing that rockers do, swiping away at his guitar, leaning into it, and into the mic, and then stopping playing, grasping the mic like he would a lover's neck. It's all an act. But it's a good one. I can imagine his line of groupies. I just can't believe Meg would be one of them.
"We're the Scarps. Silverfish is up next,"
Ben McAllister says at the end of their short set.
"You about ready to go?"
Stoner Richard asks me. But I'm not ready. I'm wide awake and furious at Ben McAllister, who, I now understand, screwed my friend, in more ways than one. Did he treat her like some throwaway groupie? Didn't he realize that this was Meg Garcia he was dealing with? You don't throw Meg away. "Not yet," I tell Richard, and then I'm up out of my seat and over at the bar where Ben McAllister is standing, drinking another beer and talking to a group of people who are telling him what a great set it was. I march up to him. But once I'm standing right behind him, so close I can see the vertebrae in his neck and the tattoo atop his shoulder blade, I have no idea what to say.
But Ben McAllister seems to know what to say to me, because after a few seconds chit-chat with the other girls, he turns around and looks at me. I saw you out there. Up close, Ben McAllister is much prettier than any boy has a right to be. He has what I can only assume are Irish good looks. Black hair, skin that on a girl would be called alabaster, but on a rocker is just perfectly pasty. Full red lips, and the eyes. Meg was right. They look like contacts.
You saw me out where? I ask.
Out there. He points to the tables in the club.
I was looking for a friend of mine. He said he'd come. But it's impossible to see anything with the lights.
He mimics shielding his eyes against the glare, just as I'd seen him do from the stage.
But then I saw you.
He pauses for a beat.
Like maybe you were who I was looking for.
Is this what he does? Use this line? Is it so rehearsed that he even plants the little eye shield squint into the crowd thing during the show? I mean, it's a great line, because if I was in the crowd, then it's like, wow, you were looking for me. And if I wasn't, well, then you said that nice thing, and what a sensitive rocker you must be to believe in something like fate. Is this the line he used on Meg? Did this work on Meg? I shudder to think of my friend falling for this crap. But then, with Meg far away from home, with glitter dust in her eyes and guitar fumes up her nose, who knows? He takes my silence for coyness.
What's your name?
Will my name ring a bell? Did she mention me to him? Cody, I say.
Cody, Cody, Cody.
He gives my name a test drive.
It's a cowgirl name,
he drawls on.
Where are you from, cowgirl Cody?
Cowgirl country. His smile is slow, like he's intentionally rationing it.
I'd like to visit cowgirl country. Maybe I can come and you can take me for a ride.
He gives me a meaningful look, in case I haven't caught the double entendre. You'd probably get bucked right off. Oh, he likes that. He thinks we're flirting, the dickwad.
Would I now?
Yeah, horses can smell fear. Something on his face falters for a second, then...
What makes you think I'm scared?
City dicks always are.
How do you know I'm a city dick?
Well, we're in a city. And you're a dick, aren't you? A flurry of confusion passes over his face. I can see he's not sure if I'm just a violent flirter, the kind of girl who'd be hot, if a little angry, in bed. Or if this has actually passed over into something else. But he arranges his face into the lazy, wannabe rock star slackery smile.
Who exactly have you been talking to, cowgirl Cody?
His tone is light, but underneath it's laced with something less pleasant. I make my voice go all breathy, the way Trisha does so well.
Who have I been talking to, Ben McAllister?
I lean in close. He leans in close, too, like he thinks we might kiss. Like most of the time, it really is this easy for him.
You know who I haven't been talking to much?
My voice is pure breath.
Who?
He says. He's close enough that I can smell the beer.
Meg Garcia. I haven't talked to Meg Garcia in more than a month. How about you?
I've heard the term recoiling before, but when I see Ben McAllister snap away from me, I understand what it means, because he jumps back like a snake, recoiling, before it strikes.
What the fuck?
He asks. The flirting portion of our evening has ended, and Ben's voice is now truly a growl, a wholly different sound from the bullshit thing he sang with. Meg
Garcia, I repeat.